are just doing a really breezy modern American style, you know, that works great. Heavily vernacularized, you know, jaunty, I mean, hip, you know, and I was reading that one, and it's like, it's got a lot of kind of staid.
Well, I hit record, so I'm going to give some context to the fact that we're talking about translations. We're going to be talking about The Master and Margarita by Mikhail Bulgakov, which Will has two different translations on his shelf.
And I need three.
Apparently. Well, you're telling me the one I read is not as breezy and Americanized as the one you read the first time, but...
Well, we're getting the very heart of art and literature, and which is tone, you know. And
absolutely. And, tone's everything.
And exactly. And there is this hidden tone in Bulgakov that is just so satiric and almost sardonic. And
okay, now I have my very first point of contention.
Okay.
I read that. I'm gonna say this straight up. Stacy bought this book many years ago, and this is how prejudiced I can be at times. I opened it up, and one of the first reviews was from Daniel Radcliffe, who you might know as the star of Harry Potter movies. He was like the actor who was the star of all the Harry Potter movies. So immediately, I read that, and I'm just being so sarcastic to Stacey. I'm like, oh well, if Daniel Radcliffe likes it, then it must be good. But he used that exact word too. He said it's got satire in it, and I read. Well, I didn't finish the book, to be completely honest. But
well, I mean, satire is a little lame, but he's an actor. I mean, at least
right.
he
but
likes it.
But you just said satire too. Where do you think the satire?
I'm just saying that satire is basically a subversive attitude toward the narrative and toward the whole process of communication, and a certain vernacular and jauntiness and tongue in cheek and a look, you know, over your shoulder is totally appropriate. You know, I mean, you cannot get too fucking staid with Bulgakov, I think, and Pavir is pretty staid. I mean, there's four syllable words in there. Anyway, back to basics. We got to get this thing started out.
Okay. It just seemed like we were going to end up talking about that anyway, so I thought might as well turn it off.
Well, I think that's just so. I think it's really interesting, and again, we will do an addendum to in a previous broadcast. I cannot remember which translators that I like. They are two American women. I think they're from the University of Texas or something.
Yeah.
And they just kind of whipped out this style that just trips along. But there are like eight different translators of The Master and Margarita, which in a way is a testament to what a great book it is.
Sure. Or it's a testament to how, what would be the word? For some reason, I just want to use the word slipstream.
I love the word slipstream. That's tremendous.
No, but that's wrong.
Because one of the scenes, of course, when she has taken the right, got the right mojo, she is in the slipstream and she is flying.
Yeah, literally
to the devil's Sabbath.
Yeah.
General reader, you have to realize. I mean, this thing. Goes from Moscow and into the upper realms of Goethe's Waldesburgis night. I mean, the festival of the witches, you know, the deepest depravity and wahooing you can get, right?
Yeah.
Out in the Russian steppes, and they're flying to it, and the whole which actually brings in echoes of Castaneda. I mean, if you get really stoned, you can fly, right? I mean, there's all sorts of stuff going on in this, or Russian mushrooms. Are they eating Russian mushrooms? You know, I don't know.
Fly with Garrick, yeah.
But no, I like the idea. It's a slipstream novel. I mean, it's just like flying along in a highly magic. It's the ultimate magical realism novel. I mean, it puts all others to shame, in my opinion. I also have to say right off the bat, I believe it's the greatest novel of the 20th century.
That's just insane to me. There's so little interiority to it. It's just images after images. There's no interiority. How could it be the best novel of the 20th century? That's crazy talk. Like, I mean, they are beautiful images. Like, you're seeing, you know, the damned come up the steps to this damned, you know, this ball, this fantastic ball. Mm. I mean, I kind
of
like...
Great this. Scene. Oh, God, the entrances of all the devils and the demiurges of hell coming up the steps and being greeted. Oh, it's a fantastic scene.
It's great, but it just makes me want it to be like an animated film or something. Mm-hmm. You know, like, it... there's like more chance to explore each of those characters like in more detail other than a passing explanation of just what they are, which it's like I get it. It's like interesting. It's got that creativity. It's got that imagination. But at the same time, it's just not what I go to novels for. Like, if I just wanted an images piled upon images, I guess.
But like, I must ask you, in the end, Jonah, what is the value of so-called interiority? I mean, you must establish a psychological and epistemological truth for interiority.
Yeah, that's exactly
because let's face it, Proust, I mean, the great interiority of 20,000 pages of Proust is all falsehood and a mask of his homosexuality.
But that's relentlessly first-person interiority. That's not interiority.
Well, at least you're qualifying it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, of course. But you have to. I mean, like, the interiority of individual characters, like... I mean, honest to God, as soon as Margarita, who's in the namesake, she doesn't appear until the second book, so she doesn't appear until 200 pages into this thing, which is kind of confusing in and of itself. But... like, as soon as she comes in, the only interior description that is given of her is just, like, that she's this beautiful young woman who's married to this rich man that she's not happy being married to, and she'd rather go live with this artist who's writing this great novel. And it's just like, okay, if you want to talk about first-person romanticization, like with Proust, here you have a writer writing something where just, you know, beautiful young women just want to go live
with her. That's only her entrance. She takes over the narrative for like 100 pages.
Yeah, well...
and then you get to know her.
I mean...
Well, she's an actor. She's a performer. And, you know, but no, I think you've really hit a really big point. A crucial issue of literature is... I really like the word in... I'm having a hard time saying it. Interiority. I mean, I really like it.
You're having an easier time than with the word component.
I am. I mean, in Shakespeare, like in Macbeth, in the soliloquies, he brings out, you know, his hallucination of the blood on the dagger that doesn't have blood on it yet. Mm. I mean, he does it in this extremely kind of objective style, right? And... okay, so what is your example of a great novel with exquisite interiority?
I mean, obviously you already know my penchant for Kundera, but... I mean, I guess more... like, Alice Walker also comes to mind. I mean,
really?
Like, Saul Bellow, obviously, but he's got that first person thing like Proust.
Right, but the interiority becomes trying to me. I mean, it's like, geez, man. I mean, how much, even Shakespeare, you'll have a little interiority, but then you get a little action, you know.
Yeah. It's true. There's a balancing act that but there's something wonderful about just following the I can see our point of disagreement on this.
No, keep going.
And
with what you're saying.
I don't need to rectify.
Why did you self-criticize yourself?
Well,
you're talking about there's something wonderful about what you were going to say.
Well, because I understand your point, and I don't feel.
No,
like
just
I,
keep
I
going
to...
with what you're talking about. I mean, you cut yourself off, not me.
Well, yeah.
There's something wonderful about an extended interior monologue or some sort of
like literally letting it sort of stand in for a full life. Like when you let that interiority span the whole scope of a novel. If you actually feel like you've gotten to know that person in some significant kind of way.
Right, but it's always a mask. It's always a persona. Yeah. It's always a projection of the artist. I mean, it's false, man.
Well, I would argue, I think Bello did a more advanced, better version of it than Proust did.
Well, at least with more, you know, dynamics.
Thrust,
thrust. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
More
so,
stuff actually happened.
Yeah, yeah, and brilliant ideas. I mean, Proust is the philosopher. He's a philosopher. He's reading Bergson. He's reading the new theories of perception and how we assimilate time and experience. So I mean, he's more scientific, and but yeah, Bello's great. But I was not impressed with Bello. So what would be another one in which interiority would be?
You know, it's a problem.
You know what I would say would be the death of Ivan Ilyich by Tolstoy.
Sure.
I think that's wonderful intrusion of the omnipresent. Fuck, I don't know.
Omnipresent. It's still got omni.
Okay, it's got
in
it in there.
In your prefix.
So. He is, oh God, he is merciless with me, gentle reader. My gosh. I grew up in Idaho. I mean, what the heck, man? But yeah, Tolstoy's intrusion into several characters, boom, boom, like that, is like spectacular.
And I mean,
it's only a short story.
Yeah. Well, Chekhov too.
Chekhov as well. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, look, honestly, it's a little bit easier for me to say who doesn't do it, and then we just get back to my dislike of genre writers. Although there are good genre writers that pull off interiority, except their interiority is almost always in service to what the plot is. Like, this person's scared of this,
right,
and that's why it's going to pay off.
Exactly so. No. Exactly so. So, after Bello, I mean, which I kind of liked, but kind of not. So you mentioned Alice Walker. Which novel of her?
I've just read her short stories. I don't think I've read one.
Right. See, so that's the point I'm making. I mean, can a novel support an artificial, I mean, let's face it, all art is an artifact and is artificial. Will you agree with me with that?
Okay.
It has a framing, you do certain ritualistic things to it, and I mean, to do a novel totally inside the person's head.
What about, you love Catcher in the Rye?
There's a lot going on in that, man.
But it's also all just inside his head.
Yeah, there's a lot going on. On top of that, it's funny.
Yeah, I mean, he gets to be funny because he gets to write a kid, you know.
There's something uncanny about it because that's the way adolescents are. I mean, and now we are getting to a truth value, you know. There's a tremendous amount of truth value in Catcher in the Rye. But okay, thank you.
Value.
I accept
I, that.
I accept
a good point of discussion. I like.
Okay, I accept that. I accept that completely. I think you're absolutely right. I think it's first class novel and definitely works. In you're just learning about how this kid relates to a lot about things outside him, and I guess that's what it is. That's what it is. I mean, is there really any interiority? No, there's not. You're always trying to relate to the outside world, right?
Well, yeah, but it's like, that's what I like, is it helps give me a sense. Like, when I see somebody else's interpretation of how they view the outside world, it sort of gives me a sense of conducting reality through my own brain, because mm-hmm. I'm like, okay, well, now if I slightly understand how somebody else thinks about it, helps me understand how I might think about it in relation to that.
Sure.
Like, other than just like some kind of political posturing or whatever.
Right. And it's interesting. I'm actually getting a little insight into this. Mark Rothko, the great expressionist painter. I think that's what abstract expressionism is a totally interior, response to the world. There's really nothing out there. This is just a human being's response, right? In color and in tone and in abstract whatever. And so I think that's really a brilliant realization for me. And anything's brilliant for me if it's new, right? But yeah, I think you're right, man. I think
Chasing after the
I
new.
think I think abstract impressionism came out of that sort of modernism, the Proustian internality. And
This is a battle that I've won, but I've taken a heavy casualty because I don't like Catcher in the Rye very much. I convinced you with the thing I don't really like.
So have you got a piece there you'd like to read?
Well, I got a couple of thoughts on it.
Okay. But I like to hear you read. You don't have one picked out, huh?
Sure. Well, I think I would read from the Pontius Pilate section at the beginning, but I would only do that because there was something interesting about the prostyle to me that actually stood out and that seemed actually helpful in how one might go about thinking about writing something, or like what he's actually doing in that. I use the word actually a lot there in that sense, but he did this thing. So I suppose I should just set up the novel really quick. It's kind of funny. I was listening to another podcast the other day that was talking about Dostoevsky's The Idiot, and they were describing how you could basically sum up The Idiot as being Mr. Jesus goes to St. Petersburg. And you could basically sum up Master and Margarita as the devil goes to Moscow, right? It's like the devil shows up and it hits some pretty standard plot points, I
Right,
feel.
but the
Like,
devil, when you finish it, is a henchman of the Lord. I mean,
oh, see, I didn't
the
even
devil is
understand.
in town to do the work for good. Well, that's in the frontispiece by Goethe.
The frontispiece?
I come to work. Well, the epigram at the beginning. I come to work evil for good.
Which eternally, yeah.
Read it.
Who are you then? I am part of that power which eternally wills evil and eternally works good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So and but and going back to Pontius Pilate, you are going to summarize it. There are two plots, and the first one is that Satan comes to Moscow and lays bare the hypocrisy and the just the tawdriness that the communism has brought to people. It's just made them worse. The simple pleasures, the simple necessities are suddenly made more bureaucratized, more difficult to get, and so they have all of Moscow has become more vicious. Now they're no different than anybody in America. I see it
Yeah.
as America. I mean, if you told some woman she couldn't have the softest toilet paper, she would fucking kill you. And this is the way it is. And this is the basic plot. I'm telling you, this is the greatest novel of the 20th century in terms of wisdom and how it is. It's got elements of sci-fi, it's got elements of fantasy, magical realism, and utter realism, in the same way that Orwell's 1984 is utterly realistic in terms of really what are human beings like. But the second plot is that the romance of Margarita, when you start reading it, you think the master is Satan, is the devil.
Why would you
Because
think
you start out with the henchman of the devil, and Satan dominates the first half of the book by going in and creating all this havoc.
Yeah, but the master's just a guy in an insane asylum.
You missed totally what I said. I mistook.
Oh, you mistook
I
it.
mistook the master as being the master, Satan, right?
Oh, okay.
Right? And he does come in contact with Margarita later on. That's true. But no, the master, has spent his whole life. He's probably the only, there are only two honest litterateurs in Moscow. One of them is the master, and he's writing the story of Pontius Pilate, the true story of Pontius Pilate and Jesus, and is hounded and persecuted because Jesus did not only live, but has no reason to live, right? And so he's been persecuted and hounded, and Margarita, the beautiful woman you introduced, idealistic, falls in love with him because of what he's doing, right? And then the second part, she pretty much flies off on her own and is hanging out with the devils, right? But you're right. Interspersed with this are excerpts from the master's novel of Pontius Pilate and Jesus. And of course, Jesus does not arrive as you seem. He arrives, he's just been beat up. He's a little pissed off about that. He's saying, "Hey, look, I don't care what you do, just don't bring that guy in here and beat me up anymore, you know." So it's just a totally a it's totally a really cool technique for just bringing a human being in. And but at every point, Jesus is going like, you know, this is going to happen to you, you know, and you know, you really ought to take care of your health. You know, your these headaches are going to get worse. You know, life is. I mean, it's a beautiful portrait of Jesus that you've never seen before. Anyway, these are the two kind of mutually exclusive parts of the plot, and as you pointed out, brilliantly, Bulgakov brings a different style in when he's doing the historical presentation of Pontius Pilate.
I think I have absolutely no way of backing this up, but just someone who's written enough things, I have a sincere suspicion that he was genuinely trying to write a novel about Pontius Pilate. And that
Because it's so good.
he couldn't, yeah, I mean,
It's so good.
yeah,
He couldn't throw it away. Yeah, exactly. A
exactly.
good writer will say, "No, I gotta put it in there
It
somewhere."
didn't have enough legs to be a full novel, but he's like, "Man, it's an interesting piece of writing." So it's like, how am I gonna tie this in? And this guy's a writer, and then the devil comes in, and that's why it feels a little disjointed to me. It's not that it doesn't work in the way you're saying it, which you actually put beautifully. It makes me like it more, just the way you described it. But I couldn't connect the dots of what, while I was reading it, I couldn't connect the dots of why, of where he was trying to go with it. Like you were telling, you're saying like, it's so there, he's laying bare the human condition. But if a magician comes into a theater and manifests thousands of dollars that then fall out of the ceiling.
That he is selling much in the way of Wheel of Fortune, you know.
Well, how do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, it's just like a modern, it would be on TV
Right,
now.
If it was to be recast as an animated movie or replotted as an
And
audio
gentle
book.
reader, these people are all on this, you know, in this opera house, and they're going up there and they're guessing right, and they're getting beautiful clothes and everything they want that the communist regime will not give them, which is essential to human nature, or at least human womanhood,
Well, shouldn't the
and it's
satire of
all in an
that?
illusion, and it's all in an illusion, and we don't want to, you know, you've got to read this book. It's just the greatest book ever. So I have to go get a beer, Jonah. So why don't you read a portion?
I'll make sure I know exactly what I'm talking about. So instead of reading a whole passage, I'm gonna really go for the weeds here. I'm gonna go for something that I noticed that can either be a translation choice or something having to do with a description of Bulgakov's style. And it's just a single sentence, okay? So, well, I'll just give the precursor. "Where's the John?" the first one in a white buttoned shirt asked with a preoccupied air. Now here's a sentence. "Something thudded against the dining table." Parenthetical. This was Nikanor Ivanovich dropping the label onto the oilcloth. End of parenthetical. Why did he not just write, "Nikanor Ivanovich dropped a ladle onto the oilcloth"? why this separation of the sentence into these two parts? I kind of liked it, but I have no understanding of what it was doing or why I might like it. I know it's kind of getting into the weeds of writing.
He's transposing reality all the time, so. But again, I would have to, read it again.
Okay, so something thudded against the dining table. Parenthetical, this was Nikanor Ivanovich dropping the ladle onto the oilcloth.
Well, that's absolute. That is. Phenomenological theory. I mean, you hear something,
but
and what is it?
But he's never in anybody's point of view.
But that's the point. It's like nobody's perceiving anything correctly, and it takes the narrator to come in here and put it in parentheses. I see it as satire myself.
Yeah, maybe it's like, it is part of the satirical essence.
It's part of the satire. Who knows, man? I see it that way.
I mean, if there was more sentences like that in the whole book,
you would have enjoyed it.
I would have enjoyed it. I really would.
That's great.
Because I was like, huh, that was just a strange way to phrase that.
Yeah.
But there's also.
But see, there's something thumped, right? And it's kind of like got this ominous, and it's comical. I mean, something thumped.
Yeah.
And then the narrator says, well, actually, he's just dropped his ladle. You know, it's like nothing, no big deal, man. But you're in an atmosphere where everything is possibly lethal. I mean, look, Jonah, you go to a cinema house for a big magic show, and you get to win lots of dollars and everything, and somebody goes up there and makes the wrong answer, and the master of ceremonies laughs jovially and takes a big scimitar out and slices the guy's head off.
See, this
and the blood starts pouring everywhere, and you're going, okay.
Now maybe this was a change in translation, because in the translation I have, it's the crowd almost wants it because they want to get on to the magic show. Mm-hmm. And there's okay. So also one of the main parts of the characters is a giant cat.
Right.
And the cat rips the guy's head off.
Right. Right.
But then immediately after he's ripped the guy's head off, everyone's sort of horrified, and then he puts it back on. And then this is one of the many people that end up in the insane asylum, because now he's forever tortured by the fact that his head was once removed from his body. So how could he?
Post traumatic stress.
Yeah, but yeah.
It's so wonderful, man.
But that's why I never got the satire in the beginning, because the stuff I liked in the beginning, I mean, it is just literally, if you were going to imagine the devil comes to Moscow, like he's not.
Could you imagine if he came to Pocatello, Idaho, where just yesterday an elected official in Pocatello said, don't get a vaccine because the government can put nanograms of tracer in it and they can trace you for the rest of your life.
What elected official?
This guy said, I can't tell you who it was, but he is of the church.
Oh, okay.
And the guy who told me it is of the church as well.
Okay.
And this is kind of not public, but he just heard it in church, and this is how it's going down in Eastern Idaho. So anyway, you can imagine what could happen if Satan came to Pocatello, Idaho, man. You would have, God knows, the anarchy and the...
Satan shows up at a Mormon temple. Pretty fun idea, actually. Well,
he could show up at Sportsman's Warehouse. I went in there wearing a mask just to be nice, right? And you can't believe the animosity I received.
Really? So, well, the opposite of almost everywhere else.
I'm just saying, man. I can't believe it. In this store, we're going to date this thing right now. In this store, people get mad at me for wearing a mask, and then other people get mad at me for not wearing a mask. It's extremely hard, you know, to kind of get your bearings. And like, what the hell's going on?
Well, this is the problem with turning things political. Now everything's political. You know, I don't know.
Exactly so, man.
Yeah.
And I mean, Satan could do it really well, man. And a couple of hallucinations. My God, this town could like rip right up the center, man. You'd have people screaming in the streets.
But this first guy, okay, this guy that he that the sentence I just read, what Satan does to him, as far as I can tell, he didn't do anything wrong. He's just, I mean, you could say he's doing something wrong by inherently being a landlord or something. Which, okay, fine. But it's like, that's never changed. That's not gonna change. Like, shouldn't satire be addressing something which is, like,
I don't say it is satire. I just say there are satiric elements in it. No, I mean, I was actually, we were originally talking about the style. There's a subversive style to the book, whether you call it satire or whatever. And but the interesting thing is, it's a Christian novel. You know, I mean, it's got some real Christian feeling in it.
Yeah, it's got a great depiction of Jesus. That makes you want to like the
It
guy.
makes a great ending, man. I mean, all the themes of, no, the ending is, I think all great novels have to have a great ending. The ending of The Master and Margarita is just spectacular, man. I mean, it's just like, it's almost as good as what's the Jodie Foster one, where you're in the, anyway.
Well, I don't know. What
What is the
what
what
stage of
Jodie
Jodie
Foster
Foster's?
was? It wasn't E.T. It might have been the last movie I saw, so I can't remember. Anyway,
This just gives you a sense of Will's
cultural and
cultural
all that.
bearing.
Jodie Foster was in a movie in which
One of the last movies.
people were traveling, and there was no time. They're traveling through wormholes or something.
Oh, the one that Carl Sagan wrote,
Right.
Contact. Yeah.
Contact. There you go. I just opened this up at random. Pavel Yosifovich was already hastening to the scene of the action. He was an imposing man in a clean white smock, like a surgeon, with a pencil sticking out of his pocket. Pavel Yosifovich was obviously an experienced man. Seeing the tail of the third herring in Behemoth's mouth, Behemoth is the cat that's 8 feet high. He instantly assessed the situation, understood decidedly everything, and without getting to any arguments with the insolent louts, waved his arms in the distance, commanding, "Whistle!" The doorman flew from the mirror door out to the corner of the Smolensky marketplace and dissolved in a sinister whistling. The public began to surround the blackguards, and then Goraviev stepped into the affair. "Citizens," he called out in a high vibrating voice, "what's going on here, eh? Allow me to ask you that, the poor man." Goraviev let some tremor into his voice and pointed to Behemoth, who immediately concocted a woeful physiognomy. "The poor man spends all his day reparating premises. He got hungry, and where is he going to get currency?" To this, Pavel Yosefovich, usually restrained and calm, shouted sternly, "You just stop that," and waved into the distance impatiently now. Then the trills by the door resounded more merrily. I mean, it's just so beautifully surrealistic and fantastic and ludicrous. I mean, you just can't beat it.
It does definitely have one thing going for it as compared to other Russian novels.
Behemoth has got a herring. He's a 6-foot-tall black cat with a herring sticking out of his mouth. God. I mean, you can just open up anywhere. It's just fantastic reading.
I don't get it. I really don't. I mean, I don't know. I don't know what I'm missing. Well, I'll finish
You
what I was going to
like
say.
interiority, that we just figured that out.
Yeah.
Well, let me see. I'm going to pick up another one.
There's one. I'm just going to finish this thought. There is one thing that this novel has on other Russian novels, especially Dostoevsky and Tolstoy, is the amount of Russian second names that he ends up using is actually significantly less compared to those guys. So you're not too bogged down in pronouns. You know, you get a lot of single name people, which is very refreshing for a Russian novel.
Yeah, Bogdan Bogdanovich. Going in where he was invited, the barman even forgot his business, So greatly was he struck by the decor of the room. Through the stained glass of the big windows, a fantasy of the jeweler's utterly vanished wife poured an unusual church-like light. Logs were blazing in the huge antique fireplace, despite the hot spring day. And yet it was not the least bit hot in the room, and even quite the contrary. On entering, one was enveloped in a sort of dankness, as in a cellar. On a tiger skin in front of the fireplace sat a huge black tomcat, behemoth, squinting good-naturedly at the fire. There was a table at the sight of which the God-fearing barman gave a start. The table was covered with church brocade. On the brocade tablecloth stood a host of bottles, round-bellied, moldy, and dusty. Among the bottles gleamed a dish, and it was obvious at once that it was of pure gold. At the fireplace, a small red-haired fellow with a knife in his belt was roasting pieces of meat on a long steel sword, and the juice dripped into the fire, and the smoke went up the flue. There was a smell not only of roasting meat, but also some very strong perfume and incense, and it flashed in the barman's mind, for he already knew of Berlioz's death in his place of residence from the newspapers, that this might, for all he knew, be a church panchita that was being served for Berlioz, which thought, however, he drove away at once, a priori, absurd. It's just a great, it's just brilliant, brilliant, brilliant
well,
writing.
Well, it's like, like the cliche with
the barman's trying to figure out what is going on here.
The cliche with the tiger skin rug. And
I loved it. I love the tiger skin rug, man.
Well, it's, I mean, yeah, I gotta admit, it's kind of a cliche, you know? And, like, when our very first guy who helps us get to the insane asylum where we eventually meet the master.
Right, right, right.
Is, like, as far as I can tell, there's no, like, that guy is just a classic example of you meet the devil, you can't explain it to anyone properly that you've met the devil, so you go insane. And, like, that to me was just such a, it was such an easy beat to hit that I didn't appreciate it. Because I just was like, okay, pretty obvious though, right? I
mean, that
like,
was the transition in the novel that was hard to work into and figure out. But that is where you meet the master.
Right.
And the whole reason for that scene, and you picked up on it, there are always, you know, there are always these little fault lines in, you know, in an artist's mind, right, in the framing. But yeah, it took me a while to figure out what the hell's going on here, and then I realize, oh, I'm meeting the master, and it's only because it goes along so interminably that you realize, yeah, he's got to get the master into this,
right?
Because Margarita's in the title, you know.
Exactly.
So,
yeah.
So we got. Yeah, I agree.
See, I had the opposite account, whereas you thought it was like, oh, I was confused about why this. I knew immediately what he was doing. Immediately,
right?
I was like, okay, boom, I see that.
But you're quick.
Well,
I did.
But
man.
I wasn't.
I was
quick.
Really bored by it.
I wasn't quick about what the rest of it was. I wasn't quick about what he was trying to do with the whole overarching
right.
arc.
Right.
I mean, when you explained it to me, it made more sense to me because it.
Right.
The whole rest of it never really added up.
But we also must explain that probably the major subdominant character is the character you meet in the first page, which is so brilliant. And hand it to me, and I'll introduce him.
Well, he's another poet.
He's a poet,
yeah.
And he is toadied to the Stalinist regime, and
that would have been more interesting if he explored that more, because
yeah.
It's not really explored about
right,
what their
right,
dynamic.
Right.
Is.
No, absolutely, and that's it. The novel takes a long time to get going, but. The person where, so we're talking about, this is also a great satire at the literary world, not only of Stalinism, but, gentle reader, America as well. Could it possibly be true?
Where
toadyism and quid pro quo and all, and
right.
various other,
yeah.
you know, certain obscene comments could be talked about.
I get that, but it's a little too easy, don't you think? I mean, it's like, it's so obviously true that you don't.
But here we go. But he's the opening line. He's the guy who ends up in the insane asylum because he can't deal with the hallucinations that we were talking about, that Satan has brought in. At the hour of the hot spring sunset, two citizens appeared at the patriarch's ponds, one of them approximately 40 years old, dressed in a gray summer suit, was short, dark-haired, plump, bald, and carried his respectable fedora in his hand. His neatly shaven face was adorned with black horn-rimmed glasses of supernatural size. The other, a broad-shouldered young man with tousled reddish hair, his checkered cap cocked back on his head, was wearing a cowboy shirt, wrinkled white trousers, and black sneakers. And that's our young poet who's writing drivel in support of the Stalinist regime.
And maybe that would mean more to me if I had grown up in, if I'd been born in 1898 in Russia, and that description of clothing meant anything to me. Description of clothing.
The Russians have always liked cowboy shirts, man. They like methadrine for the same reason. You know, they're all cowboy crackheads. They're all cowboy crackheads over in Russia, man. They're wearing cowboy shirts and cowboy hats and doing amphetamines and hanging out and being cowboys, you know, in Moscow. I've seen pictures of them, Jonah.
Well, I believe it.
I've seen it in Paul Getty images, you know, everywhere.
It's just like as soon as somebody starts describing clothes to me, though, I'm just like, okay, skip ahead, next two sentences. I just read too slowly, I think, is my problem. Like, I can't blow through a book like this because every time I get to a sentence like that, I'm like, okay, well, I don't care. Like, I just don't. I don't think I've ever cared what anybody's ever wearing.
Anyway, he is one of the characters that is actually saved by all this, who says, I'm just not going to write shit anymore. I'm just going to be a real human being.
Oh, okay.
That's... So
we could describe that as part of the moral of Master and Margaret.
It's one of the only there's a lot of the whole novel is extremely it's not tragic at all. The whole novel is extremely happy in the end, you know, in a crazy, crazy way.
Yeah.
And of course he writes it even before World War II is coming. So I mean
that's true.
He actually, yeah.
I suppose should we touch on the biographical history a little bit, just because?
Good idea.
So, well, what sort of made me postulate that he had started writing the Pontius Pilate thing first was because for the last, like, 6 years of his life, he was highly invested in the theater, which I think shows through in his prose style because it is very image-based rather than interior-based. But he had been writing these biographies. One was Molière and one was a Roman guy. But anyway, he'd written, done three biographical plays. And I sort of feel like this Pontius Pilate is like an extension of that.
Sure.
Like, he was just getting obsessed with, like, taking a historical figure and doing biographical thing about it. But Master and Margarita, what? He didn't get published until 20 years after his death?
Mm-hmm.
And it said his wife never even bothered, really, so it sat, like, in a drawer. A long time.
Well, no, it's extremely dangerous. The myth that I know is that his beautiful young wife, Margarita, he has a extremely debilitating disease, autoimmune disease of some sort, where he is totally incapacitated and goes in and out of comas. And he comes out of these and recites them to her, and she is the amanuensis. And she writes them down. So Master and Margarita is actually written by a woman.
That sounds like an interesting myth. And it's good enough I'll let it stand without
fighting. Well, it is. She's the one that transcribed it. He was unable to write. He was told in the last years of his life, he was totally unable to function, from what I read.
Yeah.
And she transposed his ramblings and put it down on paper. Now, obviously, she probably did a really good job of it, but anyway, she's half the writer. I mean, she's the one that wrote it down. That's the myth that I know.
Okay.
And myths are much superior to reality.
To reality. Well, that's true. I'm not going to argue that point.
And you have to realize this was the regime and the era in which the most famous Russian writer in the West, Isaac Babel, was picked up one day at his girlfriend's apartment and taken to a prison and shot 90 days later because he had not appeared at the writers' conference, of which he was a member. And the writers' conference plays big in the politics, the art politics of Master and Margarita. What? I mean, these are all art politicians.
What's so treacherous about not attending a conference?
It was treacherous because the last thing Babel said was, colleagues, they won't allow us to write badly anymore. Don't they realize this is the number one reason to be a writer is to write badly? And he never came, and he left. And but there's also a subtext is that his girlfriend had slept with Beria, B-E-R-I-A, who was Stalin's head of KGB, domestic. So they were worried that there might have been some pillow talk.
Why couldn't I have just read a story about this? This sounds like a great novel.
I mean, it's pretty damn spectacular.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's...
I'm just saying that Bulgakov is expecting any time for them to come and pick him up and take him to prison and shoot him. Except that he was not famous like Babel. I mean, Babel was one of the celebrated writers of the 20s and 30s.
Yeah.
And justly so.
Yeah, and probably just putting on plays in a... He's kind of like an off-Broadway play director. And it's like, nobody really cares that much. You know, he's not Steven Spielberg or something.
That's a good point. Yeah. Yeah, no, he is. He's given his soul, and he wants to be famous, obviously. You know, he wants to write plays. He wants to be produced, and nothing, man. Stalin's saying, no, this ain't going to work. And, but I mean, the psychological stress of every day of your life, you know, is just stupendous. I mean, I just think of my life. I mean, I have great dreams. I wake up in the morning. I play the guitar for a while. I write for a couple hours. You know, come here. Everybody's nice to me. It's just like, but yeah, there's just, it's a tremendous, and you made a good point. Yes. What could have been the real novel Bulgakov could have written? I don't know. But I still say Master Margarita is the greatest novel of the 20th century because one is big, it's got tremendous scenes, thousands of characters.
Yeah.
Two, it's funny. Three, it never takes itself seriously. Four, it's funny.
And honestly, you could call not taking itself seriously is also
and it's so totally original. So totally original. It's the only thing that comes close to Shakespeare and Falstaff and this. And actually, there are real similarities to the world of Shakespeare, in which Christopher Marlowe is murdered because he's making a little money on the side as a spy for one of the factions, right?
I completely disagree that this is totally original. I feel like The Master and Margarita is buried somewhere in the vast quantity of literature that's been created on this planet. There's been at least 20 Master and Margaritas that have been written. At least. I mean, not from different cultures at different times. And like, they're fantastical, very dream-based, very image-based.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I don't see it as being highly
original. Where are they?
I think there's only a limited amount of things that ever really come to the surface in, how many people have ever read the classic writer of Egyptian literature, like sort of magic realism?
Oh, yeah, it's great, yeah.
You know what I'm talking about?
Maluf.
No. Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, no, he's really good. He's fantastic.
Yeah.
Fantastic writer.
But, I mean...
But he's not as good. He's basically just like the short story writer you gave me from from Iraq or somewhere.
Oh, from Pakistan.
Or Pakistan, you know, a great writer, but you know, basically working in a forum and working it really well, but doesn't explode your experience.
Well, he hasn't even published a novel yet. He only published a book of short stories. So.
It's a great book. But
yeah,
you're right.
I mean, I might be wrong about
but
that.
But you know, and this brings another point. I mean, yes, I agree with you. There probably are nine or ten great novels that nobody's ever from Romania or Africa, some crazy place.
Yeah.
I mean, if you look at what it takes to get. I was reading about C.G., you know, Jungian psychology. Guess why we all read, being a bookseller, I picked up a biography, and it's a very catty
isn't it? It's like reading gossip. That's how I felt when I was reading it.
You saw it?
Yeah. I was going to do a play about Jung and Freud.
Oh, my God.
And so I read it, and I was like, this is like reading gossip.
Yeah, her name's Bear. It's B-A-R. Yeah. This is the cattiest, bitchiest little thing I've ever read. And I'm going, and he comes off as just like the worst person on earth. And, but anyway, the point is made is that the rich discovered him.
Right. That's
the rich discovered him, and they're flying over, gentle reader, from New York, Pasadena, Chicago, wherever. With their millions, and are just hanging out with good old Carl and just having a good old time and going back and telling everybody how great that he is. And so all of a sudden you've got Jung societies and being discovered. And you know, I was thinking about speaking of great writers, Konstantin Kavafy, the Alexandrian. A writer, Alexandria, Egypt, who only wrote in longhand and handed them out to his friends, and somehow by the European Euro connection, a few of his poems find their way to T.S. Eliot. And T.S. Eliot, who is like the major priest of modernism, tells everybody how great Kavafy is. And he is. And, gentle reader, he is writing in an ancient Greek metrical style that has not been written in for 2,000 years. But it translates absolutely beautifully into English for some weird reason, man. But yeah, you're right.
That is
what are the odds, right? The reason we read Kavafy is that somehow it just worked its way into the...
But this is okay. So, a girl came in and Will said something to the effect if somebody came in and said they had read The Master and Margarita, we were going to bring them in, and for some reason a girl came in, a young girl, probably Mormon.
She read it before her mission.
She read it, and
she said it was the greatest novel she'd ever read.
But this is exactly what I'm talking about. This is exactly my whole Daniel Radcliffe problem, okay?
Like, who is Daniel Radcliffe?
Okay, let me just explain this to you.
Harry Potter.
The Harry Potter
guy.
I knew a girl in college who, she only watched two movies, and they were the Harry Potter movies on repeat. She never watched anything else. I'm just saying there's a certain level of magical realism. In this... Margarita literally flies on a broom. I know you don't like it for this reason. I'm just saying, perhaps part of its influence into the culture is this boon of this image-based magical realism, easy for kids to read. I mean, look, Master and Margarita is not going to hold you up somewhere with some deep philosophical thought.
That's not true.
It's just not.
Oh, that's not true.
What? I mean, there's just no spot where it's going to... There's no spot where I ever read a paragraph and been like, huh, I had trouble parsing that paragraph. I'm going to have to go back and read it again. It was the opposite of that. I'm like, okay, I get
it's
exactly
slapstick.
What this is saying. So,
you're absolutely right. It's slapstick. Yeah. Yeah.
And
okay, where's that book again?
It's right
I have to defend myself. You're right. Slapstick character. Yeah.
I mean,
there she is on the broom. On top of that. And she's naked, too.
Right, writing it.
That's true. That's a big, that's a big plus.
Writing it the opposite way of how most people would conceive of. Right. Russians ride brooms broom side first. I don't know what that says about the Russian character. But
it would be more genteel to ride the broomstick side saddle. That's true. It brings up all sorts of subliminal concepts.
Yeah, just big bushes on Russian women. Got to throw a little comedy into the podcast.
In Yaroslavl, a citizen came to a restaurant at lunchtime carrying a Primus, which he had just picked up from being repaired. The moment they saw him, the two doormen abandoned their posts in the coat room and fled, and after them fled all the restaurant's customers and personnel. With that, in some inexplicable fashion, the girl at the cash register had all the money disappear on her. There was much else, but one cannot remember everything. Anyway, yeah, I don't know. I guess that's why I liked it so much. I didn't have to parse anything.
Yeah.
I just laughed. I loved the surface of irony, and you're right. He's playing with the tone and line of the novel the whole time. Yeah.
I
think that's what I love about it. You're right, the element of play in it. Here's a guy that is so sick and destroyed, and the element of play is so spectacular.
Well, if your myth is correct, he's literally spending hours and days locked into a dream state.
Right.
And like, how does that affect your waking consciousness? I mean, like,
right.
I mean, it makes it easier for to, right. Well, right. Not easier. I mean,
right, not exactly.
But
so
the way the images
exactly
are
so
pile on each other.
It is always one and the same thing that awakens the scholar and draws pitiful cries from him, on the night of the full moon. He sees some unnatural, noseless executioner who, leaping up and hooting somehow with his voice, sticks his spear into the heart of Justus, who is tied to a post and has gone insane. But it is not the executioner who is frightening so much as the unnatural lighting in this dream, caused by some dark cloud boiling and heaving itself up upon the earth, as happens only during world catastrophes. Yeah.
Maybe,
like that, man.
Maybe he was a shaman. Maybe he was making the prediction of world catastrophe.
Oh, you're right about the dream, though. I mean, yeah, well, that's the difference between you and I. I like the irrational because it cannot be parsed. I like the sublime, he said. That cannot be parsed, cannot be divided, cannot be understood. I like whiskey.
But there's something about looking reality in the face that is sublime to me. There's nothing that feels more sublime to me than seeing things as they are. You know, like, and I think that's the, maybe I'm just putting too much of a burden on him to prove himself as a satirist. Like, because
it is not satire.
Right.
I've repeated that twice.
Yeah, and nobody else.
I use that as an adjective.
Yeah, and nobody else in their reviews ever uses the word satire, and I think that's accurate because it's. I don't think it is very satirical, but I think I would have liked it more if the satire was more obvious in some kind of way, or if there was. I don't know what I'm left to chew on. I don't know.
Right. I don't. I think that's a good point. I mean, just the two or three things I read. I mean, he's just a writer. I mean, he is. He is just going.
But he's not really. He's like
he's going through moods.
This is his only novel.
He's going through mood swings but tonally it's correct all the way through there. He goes from this high slapstick Groucho Marx violent comedy into these really somber horror. I mean that's an image right out of Goya. I mean. a noseless executioner, you know, and this, you know, but that's not what's scary. It's the light, right? That he's coming out of, you know, these images of horror. I think it's a, I just think it's a really, in terms of honesty, Jonah, I think it's like, he just wrote something that was like, he was just writing the same way you write.
No,
He
not
just has a
exactly.
different style.
Yeah, I don't think we write the same way at all.
No, you don't write the same at all, but you write the same way in terms of you write how you want to write, you know, and
Well, not really. I don't know.
you don't? You don't write the way you want to write?
Not really.
Really?
I do sometimes. I let myself indulge in that. But yeah. Well, actually, we were talking about this last time, and it was kind of helpful for me to say it out loud, but it's maybe kind of boring, but it's like I got really stuck on just one sentence for like 2 weeks because I had nothing more explicit to say. I didn't have anything more that had any meaning to the novel. Like I was just gonna write something, and then when I'm just writing something, I get kind of clogged up because I'm like, well, what's the point of this? I mean, look, I think it's just maybe this has always been the case, but there's been so many thousands and thousands of books that's ever read. Nobody could even possibly begin to read them. Like, there's been so many people who want to be writers. We have this metaphysical limitation on w wanting to be famous, to wanting our lives to have meaning, right? So there's all kinds of people who go out there and write stuff continually. And there's just stuff on the internet everywhere. There's writing, 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 writing everywhere. It's everywhere, okay? Especially if you go looking for it. And there's, I don't know. I guess it's like I consider it an obligation to make it count or make it purposeful when it's supposed to be purposeful. I don't know. It's probably just a hang up I have about it. It's like my own problem or something. Undoubtedly,
So
that's what it
my question is, okay, after you got this sentence, what did you write then?
is. Well, I just waited until I figured out what I was going to say next.
Right. Interesting. So, well, I mean that's a really good point, is that you want to create meaning like now, and I find that an extremely harsh regimen. It's like I find meaning in context. Cast the net wide enough, maybe something's gonna happen, right? And
You want to be more explicit about that?
thank you. Yes.
I think I vaguely get what you're saying. I mean,
Well, I mean, it's the whole point. What is meaning? What is meaning? I mean,
well, yeah,
it's a
that's
hell
true
of a
too.
hard thing to figure out.
That's true
And
too. Yeah.
we go back to my critique of your idea of internal truth. I mean, it's one of the great philosophical ideas we were talking about, Kierkegaard,
Yeah.
of the only truth is individual in a very bizarre time now. I mean, we got a great bunch of, but these crazy motherfuckers are like selling their madness and internal truths on platforms, right? And selling for $4.99 and invading the Capitol. I mean, these people should just be. What should we do? I think we should put them in the middle of the Mojave Desert because they're all overweight, every one of them. Put them in the middle of the Mojave Desert with a jar of peanut butter, like on a June day. Or the craters of the moon. Why be arbitrary? Maybe some lava. But no, it's the truth. Yeah, I agree with you. The truth, individual truth, is the only individual truth. I think meaning is like, what really? I mean, it's a pretty hard regimen. The experience of life, the people that we know, the things they talk about, you know, these are all things that really make no claim to truth. And that's why I like to write about them. I mean, I like to write about people who have no claim to truth. This guy walked in the other day. Actually, he was at the gym, and he's got the do-rag, the red, white, and blue do-rag, and the guy fucking stinks. Like, I couldn't believe it. It fucking stunk to hell, man. He's on a gym thing. I'm going, God, I don't know, man. This guy's pretty rough, but I can handle it. And I'm working out, and he's talking. And he says, "Yeah, I got my. Didn't have a driver's license for 2 years, man. I've been walking for 2 years. I just got it back, man. God, it's been great. Every insurance company in America is just begging for my insurance because I haven't had a wreck or anything in 2 years. They haven't looked up why I lost my license, but anyway. So I said, what kind of truck do you have? And he says, well, I got a 1996 Dodge, and it's a V6. And man, when I lost my license, I put it on the block, and it sat there for 2 years. And yesterday, I went and I put a new battery in, and I changed all the oil, and got in it and started up, and here I am in all my glory. It was like, this is real, man. It may have no meaning, but it's real. This guy is real. And gosh knows, you know,
yeah, but
how what he has been through to arrive. I mean, obviously he's just a fucking redneck idiot, but he's got a certain amount of a line, man, coming out with that line, and here I am in all my glory. Well, it ain't that glorious, but you know.
I see. I'm actually on board with that, but at the same time, I am really not, because you are not a good journalist or study of human character. Like, why did he lose his license for 2 years? I feel like this is information you could have gotten very easily if you had bothered to ask. And then you would have fleshed out your story and no point of where it might have been at least closer to a sense of meaning. Maybe it's not perfect.
Well, I think
meaning,
you make a good
closer.
Point, Jonah. I really don't want to work hard enough to get any meaning. I just thought he was glorious. I think... you know, I think I'm more with Delacroix. I mean, let's just have some slashes. You know, let's just get a little image of a Corsair in the rain or, you know, somewhere. Yeah, that's true. That's true. There would be more meaning there, but I know why he lost his license.
Yeah, you don't have to know why.
He's a loser, and he got drunk, and it had been his third or fourth one. And I mean, as everybody knows, that's how it happens. But is that meaning? No. Is his validity as a human being valid?
All right, okay.
No.
Let's really.
Is my validity as a human being valid? No, I don't see, really, is there any meaning other than, really good writing and entertaining? I mean, I can open up Master Margarita anywhere, and it's never boring. It's never stayed. That's why I like really fresh translations of it.
Yeah, but let's really pursue this, okay? Because this is a very compelling argument that you're giving. But let's say he lies about it, or he presents to you a justification, like as is always said about criminals or people who end up in jail. It's like they're all innocent, right? Because all crime is committed by people who find a justification somewhere in their history for the way they behaved. Is that not more interesting than just the picture of him? Like, if you get a sense of his justification, like, why is he so smelly? Did nobody ever tell him that he had bad body odor? What, did he live in a household that everybody just had body odor? Did he break his nose and he can't smell anything anymore? You know, like, these are all the details. Like, okay, maybe you're
correct.
See,
that was the interesting thing about him. He didn't smell like a guy who, and trust me, as a public servant as I am, he didn't smell like an old guy that doesn't really, he wears the same clothes over and over again, and he doesn't shower. I mean, it was just pretty raw. And but you know, you're absolutely right, and there has been criticism of my writing for this reason, because, but I'm really not interested in it, man.
Yeah,
I just think the line is funny, and in a way, like we keep talking, you brought real insight to me. Yeah, Bulgakov obviously just wants to write plays and entertain.
Yeah.
He doesn't want anybody to think about, he's only got an hour and a half. He doesn't want anybody to think too hard. He just wants them to laugh and be happy, right? And that's true. That's
that's
part of my philosophy.
I wish I could really... I think you're probably right. I wish I could really back you up. How much do you know about Molière? Because in the
one of my favorites, the greatest.
Okay, so there you go. Exactly, right. That was Bulgakov's favorite as well. It was Molière.
Really?
Yeah. So is Molière just an entertainer? Basically, is that what I haven't read very much Molière.
Well, you know, they talk about the Enlightenment, and I can say that the misanthrope is as finely machined as a Swiss clock. I mean, every line just makes you laugh. It's just unbelievable, you know. And it's in French, it's rhymed, you know. I don't like to read it. There's never been a translation rhymed. The rhyming just destroys it in English, because you can't get a really good, just free translation. But
yeah,
I mean, when after the first couple of, you know, misanthrope's got his buddy, and it's just two guys talking, Jonah.
I did
You'd
try
love
reading
it.
That. I didn't like it.
I think it's because you try to read it in a verse
maybe
couplet. Just read it in the free form. But after the first couple of lines, you anticipate everything the misanthrope is going to say. What's his name anyway? You anticipate everything he's going to say, and he does, and you're ready to laugh. I mean, it's just like the whole play is like that. I mean, it's so spectacular, I can't believe it. And it's just like from the beginning to the end, you're laughing the whole time, man, because he is never tricking you. He's never disappointing you. You know he's going to give you a line that's going to fit into what he's already given you, you know. So there's a certain amount of, you're right, spoon-feeding here, man. I mean, Molière is just... and Molière had an unfaithful wife that... He was the most unhappy man ever. I mean, all his comedy just came out of... total misery. Something created that. Oh, my gosh. We got to do the misanthrope next time. But he does bring in the idea of meaning, like what we've been talking about. The misanthrope is continually bringing the idea of,
well, maybe he's bumping up against it, right?
He's like constantly.
He only wants, I mean, if you go by the classic definition of what misanthropic is.
Constantly.
Yeah.
Like you would say, hey, wait, Jonah, why did you tell that guy that, you know, he really smells bad. I mean, it really wasn't that bad, and now he hates you.
Well, he might hate me
because his girlfriend's standing there. But why did you do that? And you, Jonah, would say, "Well, I wanted the truth. I wanted him to. I thought it might be good for him to hear me tell you this." I'm going, "Actually, Jonah,
this is
he wants to kill you now."
This is part of my fucking personality too. This is. I got really drunk on Saturday, and I went into this basement bar in Pocatello, which is damn cool, by the way. They had a 5-piece band that was rocking out, and I was the only guy in the audience. It felt like they were just playing a whole set for me. It was right. It was remarkable. But the first guy's up there, and he's just playing his guitar by himself, and he's just doing big chords. And I just go up to him, and I'm like, I've already had like 12 drinks, and I go up to him, and I'd be like, "You know, man, really, you should try to put more feeling into it. You know, it's like you're going through the motions, but I thought I was doing something nice. See, yeah, he probably hates me forever now. Or
you're
just
an
thinks
artist.
I just thinks I'm a jerk or whatever."
You're a teacher. Yeah. No, you're a teacher. And, but yeah. Yeah, that's really interesting. We've got to take up Molière next week, man.
I wonder if I can get next through month. The misanthrope. Well, this will be good.
Do not read the Richard Wilbur. Talk about art politician Richard Wilbur, Robert Pinsky. They're all like full names, Robert. But anyway, Wilbur's translation's horrible. Just a free verse one, just giving the free play of oh my, and all the characters, and the women are fantastic. The women characters are in The Misanthrope are fantastic, and they're just shaking their head. And but no, he wants to be honest. He wants everybody to be honest, and everybody's going, "Are you kidding me?" You know, and
Can't be, yeah, it's not.
but he hangs on. But you realize that part of his stance is extremely grounded in his egotism and his desire to be first and to be kind of like, I'm the only honest guy around, right?
Yeah, it's what makes him end up hating people. Yeah.
Well, no, it being totally honest gives him a leverage, a supposed leverage.
But it's got to be just in his mind. I mean, that would be the only way the comedy would occur.
It's what I'm saying, it's sublime. This little thing in his personality is the thing that drives it for you as a viewer. Because you're going, okay, you know, where is his soul? Like you say, you're talking about literature, you know, fleshing out the character. Molière does it so subtly, you're just going, boy, this guy actually really likes to create a certain amount of havoc because it gives him a certain power, right?
Course, yeah.
And but again, the idea of meaning, okay, where's the meaning here, right? It's a slippery, slippery slope, man, and again, Molière married to a woman who's fucking all the good-looking French
I
boys.
mean, that in and of itself is an interesting story. I mean,
Well, it's just
and this
I
is the
think, and
problem
he
with all the
stayed
writers
married,
you like.
and he stayed married to her too,
Yeah, which is weird. Like, why? Like, was he
because he
ugly?
loved her.
Well,
And he's crazy. I don't know. Great artists are crazy, man.
yeah.
They
Well,
are. I'm not crazy. I wish I were, so I could, you know, but I've always just kind of liked to hang out
people
and
who are crazy are always the first to say they're not crazy.
I know, I know, I know.
I don't even think that's true.
It
I just thought it was funny.
is true,
Yeah,
man. Open a
it
bookstore in Pocatello, hang out
was
for 50 years. Yeah, no, I love the you know, the paradox. If you can get a paradox at the core of, you know, any work of art, short story, whatever, so people can't really figure out actually what is going on here. But yeah, Molière keeps playing with it. I've got to reread that now. And just see the whole thing, but boy, the precision of it. The one-liners, I mean, Mel Brooks, Henny Youngman, they have nothing on Molière, man. He's just like, God, you know their characters, you know they're gonna, you don't know what they're gonna say, but when they say it, you go, yeah, he's gonna say that. It's just like, boom, boom, boom. And yeah, he wrote it all in couplets, you know? So all the dialogue has just kind of got that kind of like, you know, Cezanne-like energy to it, you know, and rhythmic energy, was frequency to it. If he didn't write it in the couplets, it wouldn't have that. We're going back to Cavafy writing in these metrical styles. It's hidden there somehow. There's just kind of like this structure hidden beneath it, where if you're just writing realistic English dialogue, you kind of say, well, I need a couple more things here. And so you lose that. Somehow you lose this kind of interior energy to it. It's very, I think this is one of the biggest ideas we've come up with, really.
Yeah. I suppose if I was going to be an actual intellectual, put my money where my mouth is, I suppose I should read it in French too, and with my French dictionary next to me, and just do the damn thing myself.
Well, I read French really well, but
I mean, I took a few
are you,
classes.
I mean, reading Shakespeare is hard enough, and to delude yourself that you're picking up on all the subtleties of
Yeah.
sixth, 17th century French language. I mean,
well, then like no, then fucking... you need your secondary text that explain right. to you what you're reading, and then,
right.
so you get the poetry, you get the French, you get your secondary text that explain
Gosh.
It.
Hasn't this theme become recursive? We began with the problem of translation.
Oh, yeah.
And no, I know that once upon a time I read a really good translation by somebody who really knew French and could give those little tonal subtleties of sarcasm, of hidden aggression, of hiding, of whatever, and got it in there somehow. And I'm going, oh man, I'm really with this. This is like, so yeah, a great translator is.
Yeah.
Yeah, they say that Gregory Rabassa made Marquez. There are people who say that Rabassa was a better writer than Marquez.
Really?
Could be true. And that would go in line with Jorge Luis Borges, who talks about... You
well,
know,
Borges is just such a thinker. I don't think it would really make that much of a difference.
No, that was one of his points, is that the translator can take anything like that we said tonight,
yeah,
and translate it into Russian, and all the Russians think we're the two most brilliant people on earth, which is not true. But if he is, we are. That's the essence of energy.
It's
and thought.
Everything. It's about meaning. It's about the absence of meaning. it's everything that literature.
At the end, they threw their glasses against the wall.
And yeah. said, I no longer need to see the truth.
It's true, man. It's true. A brilliant translator will make the most mediocre writer brilliant. That's just the truth of it. Because it's the nature of text.
I question that. I mean, I think it's an interesting thing to talk about.
But Borges said it. So it's true, right?
Well, I like Borges that much. But I
was being slightly satirical.
Yeah, I got it.
Slightly ironic.
I should have just laughed. Left it at that, but
I'm so rarely ironic that you know you weren't sure, but I still believe it's true, because it's all about, you know, just subtleties of irony and that make it. And you want to read something good, man? Sir Francis Richard Burton. Okay, this is a teaser. This is the City of Saints by Sir Richard F. Burton, who wrote The 1001 Nights, who translated...
The first translator of 1001
Nights. You can open up just anywhere, and the heavy, sarcastic irony is everywhere. I'll just throw out one line. As you know me, I just open up anywhere because I'm
Yeah, that's unprepared. That's the way to read.
After this aperçu of the motives which sent me forth, once more a pilgrim, to young Mecca in the West, of the various routes, and of the style of country wandered over, I plunge at once into personal narrative. I mean, fuck, you talk about heavy with parody. And I mean, it's like, the whole book is like this, man.
I like that, but that's true, too. I mean, I think that's one of the things that's kind of enjoyable about travel, is it's sort of a solipsistic exercise in a weird way.
Oh, it's just hilarious. As might be expected of the Indian's creed, it has few rites and ceremonies. Circumcision is unknown.
Those heathens.
And it ignores the complicated observances which, in the case of the Hindu pantheist, and in many African tribes, wait upon gestation, parturition, and lactation. The child is seldom named. There are but five words given in regular order to distinguish one from another. There are no family names. The men, after notable exploits, are entitled by their tribes to assume the titles of the distinguished dead, and each fresh deed brings a new distinction. Some of the names are poetical enough. The Black Knight, for instance, the Breaker of Arrows.
it's like real. I like the Breaker of Arrows, because it's like, Does that mean he's a good shot or a bad shot?
I know. Anyway, I mean, I'm realizing Hunter S. Thompson and all these guys read 19th century writers, because it's all, you know, how coy can you make your style to where the person reading can never know, okay, when's he going to be serious? He's giving me information, but when's he going to be serious? Oh my God, the breaker of arrows. So, yeah, there's a certain amount of, but he's breezing over the fact he knows nothing about the Indians. But that's the point he's making. I mean, yeah, obviously, I don't know a fucking thing I'm talking about. I'm just,
yeah,
you know, just trying to make you laugh, man. Yeah. So getting back to meaning. This is huge, man. This is like...
It's a big book.
800, and they're like small print. I don't know, man.
Well, I just don't know that much about Thomas Burton's life. I mean, like, I know...
Richard Francis.
Oh, yeah. Richard Francis.
Yeah, no, he's the guy that...
it's Burton...
The Richard Francis Burton.
Doing it. Oh, okay.
No, he traveled because he wanted to see the Mecca. He wanted to meet Brigham Young, and because he always liked the idea of harems. And...
Of course. What man hasn't... at least indulged that thought. Whether or not they came to the conclusion that that would be more work than
I tried in brief moments, but... I couldn't get everybody... I somehow wanted to be secretive. I didn't want to be honest about it. I think that's the key to being having a harem. Is being honest.
Well, also having your women indoctrinated before you...
Yeah, they've got to be preternaturally disposed to something like this. He knew that Joseph Smith was a prophet, that his predictions had been fulfilled and were daily fulfilling to the joy of all the saints. He would not stop there in his testimony. He would bear testimony to the teachings of President Brigham Young. His counselors, Heber C. Kimball and Daniel H. Wells, were also true as the revelations of Joseph, and he rejoiced in them. Oh, what a joy it was to know they had such men to lead them. What would be the condemnation of those who rejected their testimony? Ezra was quite serious, yea, serious to shuddering.
That's a beautiful turn of phrase.
Serious to shuddering?
Yeah. That's...
My God, how much whiskey was he drinking when he was writing this? Oh my God. Okay, funny. With this, gentle reader... We went from Mikhail Bulgakov to Sir Francis Richard Burton.
We did.
Do we have touched left? Upon the meaning of meaning itself.
We did. At least as well as meaning is able to be explained in its own terms by using the word meaning. Yeah. So, do you think your judgment overrides my judgment? I'm willing to accept that, actually, that you're more correct than me on this one. You see the truth more clearly, or not the truth, the lack of truth, the play, whatever you want to call
it. I think that's right. I think my belief in the lack of truth in a novel is like number one.
Yeah.
You know, obviously I enjoy Richard Francis's writing. He is not working very hard in his research. He is like, yeah. I think I still. For the amount of joy it gave me, I still think it's the greatest novel of the 20th century. And I think next week you bring one, or next month, and I'll read it. And I think we'll just kind of, it'll be a match of titans.
Sounds good. Well, there we go. I'm going to go pee.